Welcome back to the Digital Orthopedics Podcast and our audio series from the 9th annual DocSF Experience. My name is Dr. Stefano Bini, and I am the host of this podcast and the founder and chair of the DocSF conferences. This session from the DocSF 2024 conference, our 9th, focused on the future of robotics in surgery. It begins with a reflection on past sessions and introduces the topic of robotics by comparing current medical robots to more advanced models seen at technology conferences from companies working with, say, industrial robots. Speakers Dr. Stefan Kreutzer and Hans-Peter Bronmo shared their expertise and perspectives. Dr. Kreutzer discusses his extensive experience with various robotic platforms and the challenges of robotic surgery, including their costs and the lack of clinical data to support their use at this time. Bronmo, with a background in AI and robotics from leading Google X's Everyday Robots project, explores broader robotics challenges, such as the complexities of robot-human interfaces and the teaching of robots, in other words, how they are taught their tasks. The session touches on the potential of AI and robots to improve surgical outcomes and efficiency, while highlighting the importance of collaborative dialogue involving diverse perspectives. The conversation concludes with philosophical reflections on the future role of humans as robots continue to evolve, and asks the very important question of what it means to be human if robots take on the tasks that we humans have historically used to define ourselves by. This is a really good one. Enjoy it. Awesome sessions up to date. I really enjoyed that from OrthoGrid. I just want to recall a little bit back how Tom brought us back to reality and the practical. And now we're going to go into the next session. We called it the Jetsons and the Future of Robotics. It has been of great interest to me for a long time. I do use robotics in surgery. I find it to be fantastic. I do think they add value. It's an ongoing debate as to whether or not they do. But I also keep going to these tech conferences and I see robots that look very, very different from the ones that we use in the OR. And I wanted to have a conversation about how those two worlds are going to come together and where are the best opportunities to see those two worlds come together. So couldn't think of better people to join us for that conversation. First speaking is going to be Stefan Kreutzer, who I've known for quite some time. He's a regular attendee at DocSF. I had the opportunity to go operate with him in Texas when I went to another conference. And I have to say, he's not only a terrific surgeon, but he really understands robots. That particular day, I think we went through four different robotic platforms that you showed us how to use and the various opportunities that each offered. And I thought that was fantastic. And so he's here to tell us a bit of his journey in robotics. And following him is Hans-Peter Bronmo, who I'm honored to call a friend. He's an extraordinary human being. He's been in high-tech MIT training. The reason he's here today is he was working for the Everyday Robots project, which is an AI meets robotics moonshot at Alphabet. Now, Google X, I think they call themselves the Alphabet Factory or something, the Moonshot Factory. It's an incredible place where they're given the resources to innovate, to think through how to move the ball forward. And Hans-Peter's work was really and truly at the cutting edge of robotics for 5 years. And I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with him about where he sees the future of robotics go. Then with Stefan in the room, the three of us can sort of bring it back to how can we see these technologies come forward. So I'm really excited for this session. I think I'll bring Stefan Kreutzer up to stage. Thank you. Please invite him back to the DocSF stage.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Stefan. And it's one of my favorite conferences. There's too many conferences these days, so I try to really pick and choose which ones I go to, but this is definitely one of my favorite ones. Thank you for the introduction. So I've been involved in robotics since, I think, the 2003. That's when I did my first robotic case, and I've been fortunate to be involved in some of the development of the different platforms, participated in a couple of FDA clearance studies. So again, there's so many different technologies I'd suggest and see what are other people doing in robotics and how can we further improve robotics and orthopedics. Here are my disclosures, and they are somewhat relevant as I have some royalty-bearing contracts. Interestingly enough, every time a new technology comes to market or gets introduced into any kind of field, there's always the naysayers. And then this was an article that was written probably 15 or so years ago by three of the giants in orthopedics, Bob Booth, Pete Sharkey, and Parvizi. And they said that knees are doing really well. We have a 98% survival rate at 10 years and 95% survival rate at 20 years. And we need to be really careful of introducing a new technology that may make things worse, because at the end of the day, we are always told first do no harm. And they mentioned a few other things like Metal on Metal and Modular Next, who has been an absolute disaster. So they were not very much in favor of robotics. And they felt that it was really from the device companies, they wanted to sell more implants. So can they add technology in order to improve things so that they can increase the cost of care? And that was really their major concern, because these robots are not for free. You know, they range anywhere from 400,000 to $1.5 million. And if you have a full platform, it could be even more than that. And so they were sort of naysayers to that. If you look back in history, IBM, on seeing its first mainframe computer in 1943, says, I think there's a world market for maybe 5 computers. I think I've got 10 computers in my house. And furthermore, Steve Ballmer at USA Today on April 30th, when he saw the iPhone, stated that there's no chance that the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. And I think probably most people here in this room have an iPhone. So they were wrong as well. So I do think robots are here to stay. But what have we learned? It takes more time to do surgery, that is for sure. So an average of 15 to 20 minutes. It is more costly. And again, these platforms can range anywhere from 500,000 to $1.5 million. And then there's the added cost on a per case from a disposable standpoint. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of clinical data to support its use. And if you look at randomized controlled trials, there are very few out there. I think there are a lot of sponsored, highly biased research studies out there showing that there's an improvement, but really, I think the clinical data is severely lacking. And we need to be careful, because we're spending too much money in this country. The U.S. currently spends more on healthcare services than any other country, exceeding almost $4 trillion in 2019, and it's projected to be $6 trillion by the year 2000. To give you a relationship, the second most expensive country is Switzerland, where I grew up. And they only spend 11% of GDP. So cost is certainly getting out of control. So we need to balance cost to what? Clinical success? And we know that from multiple publications all over the world, doesn't matter what implant you use, the clinical results are still ranging, but in the 80s to 90%, but 12 to 90% of patients are dissatisfied with their knee. Well, maybe it's an issue of the target. Maybe we just don't know what target we're trying to aim for. And if you look at this publication, it talks about the different alignment technique. And you would think that 10 orthopedic surgeons in a room could agree how to do a knee replacement. But there is mechanical alignment. There's kinematic alignment. There's adjusted mechanical alignment. There's functional alignment. There's inverse kinematic alignment. And now there's even the restricted inverse kinematic alignment. So we just can't agree on how to do a knee replacement. And despite that, the adoption rate for robotics is quite high. It's projected to be almost 50%. And the main market holder is Mako, with some of the other ones sort of lagging behind. So now I want to just kind of go a little bit of history of robotics. The first robot that was ever developed was way ahead of its time. It was an autonomous robot. And it got FDA clearance in 1992. And it really tried to solve the problem of press-fit hip implants, to try to mill the bone inside the bone to get better ingrowth. The physician had significant safety concerns early on. They had some complications with bone fractures and soft tissue damage, and it really never took off. It was quite successful in some of the Asian countries, but it really never took off. It was then rebranded as T-Solution 1 and did receive FDA clearance in 2019 for total knee replacement, and I was part of the FDA clearance study for that. But at that time, they already had significant competition with Mako and Rosa and some of the other robots on the market. Mako Surgical was really the main winner in robotic surgery and still is to this day. It was founded in 2004. Makoplasty was then launched in 2006 and received FDA clearance in 2008. And subsequently, the total knee was cleared in 2017. It really was focused on partial knee replacement first, but now has 3 platforms. Mako was then acquired by Stryker for $1.65 billion, which is, if I remember correctly, 13 times annual sales. And the acquisition really, and Mako helped them become one of the leaders in knee replacement, despite the fact that they have a 30-year-old knee that is on that platform. They really took a significant market share. So in comparison, there are several different robotic platforms, and I'll go through those one by one. again, the autonomous robot by Think Surgical is a fully autonomous robot. You plan the surgery, you set up the knee, and then you hit a button and it mills the bone. We did quite a few of those. I think I did over 400 cases. But unfortunately, because of the poor adoption rate, Think Surgical discontinued the robot in the United States and now are coming out with different technologies. Mako is a haptically guided robot, so it's not completely autonomous. So the surgeon holds the saw, and it's kind of like the brakes in your car that when you park it in the garage, where it automatically puts on the brakes so you don't hit the front of the garage. So it's an interactive tactile feedback technology, and it's really CT-based planning software, and it works quite well. Incidentally, Mako has never done a system accuracy study, so we still to this day do not know how accurate their system is. The next is Navigated Burr by Cori, which was acquired by Sniff and Nephew. Initially, it's done with a surface registration, so it doesn't require preoperative imaging. I've integrated with an MRI-based planning software to further improve the accuracy and workflow and planning capabilities. The next is Zimmer Biomet, which is a navigated cutting block. I think it's had some challenges getting a high adoption rate in the United States because it's really doesn't really change much except that it holds the block in the right position. And then the Omnibot is just recently came out with a new system called the Apollo. I've done about 22 cases with this one. In my opinion, that's one of the best ones on the market currently. It's a motorized cutting block that's actually directly attached to the femur. So it really solves some of the problem of accuracy from a navigation standpoint where you have to track the saw with the actual robot. It's very precise and it has an added function where you can actually measure soft tissue tension within newtons per square inches, which adds another complexity to the surgical planning and execution. And then the last one is the Velus, which I'm not familiar with. I've never used this one, but it's a real-time interoperative data acquires. It does not require a CT scan from my understanding. It's integrated with the DePuy implants. It's much smaller. It's more efficient, especially in a surgery center. And I think it's quite efficient market. So my question is, are we putting the horse behind the cart, or what we say, the cart in front of the horse, by developing all these robotic platforms where we really can't even agree on how to do a knee replacement? And maybe we should put more efforts into figuring out where should the implant go? Because again, what is the bony target? Well, again, we don't know. What is the soft tissue target? Well, currently we're not measuring soft tissue tensioning. And then finally, what is the best implant to use? Because if you look at the implants, this is what was initially designed over 30 years ago. This is what we use today. It really doesn't look any different. So maybe we should rethink on how we design implants in order to further try to improve knee replacement surgery. And this is Moore's Law, as I'm sure many of you are familiar. When you compare a chip from 1971 with a sixth generation Intel Core processor, it's 3,500 times better performing, it's 90,000 times more energy efficient, and 60,000 times lower in cost. If a VW bug would have improved at the same rate, it would drive 300,000 miles an hour, would get 2 million miles per gallon, and would only cost 4 cents. Don't we wish? So the challenge in healthcare is that it has really impeded us. While robotics has improved, from a development standpoint, it's very long. If a company decides to develop a new implant, first they got to put together a surgeon team. Then they got to meet and kind of figure out what they want to do. Then they do some cadaver workshops. Then the design freeze. Then they have to do testing, FDA submission, FDA clearance. Limited market release just to the design surgeons. They get back together, give them feedback, improve the instrumentation. There's some modification. Then there's a launch. Then you have to do clinical study. So this process can take 7 to 10 years. So from the day you decide to develop a new implant, it can take 7 to 10 years before you get to market. And that, I think, has really impeded our progress in orthopedics. So is robotics the solution for the future? I don't know. Maybe artificial intelligence, machine learning, and digital twins will help us really change the game for our patients. As Albert Einstein said, we cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we use to create them. Thank you very much.
Hans Peter, yield the stage and take the other perspective, then we'll come up and join you again and have a conversation.
Good morning. Try to get a robot to do that. or this. So I know nothing about orthopedics except I've had two ACL replacements. And so as Stefano was saying, but I do know a little bit about robots and AI. And so as Stefano was saying, I'm going to sort of pop it up a level and just talk a little bit about what the state of robotics and AI is today, more generally, not specific to your industry because I know nothing of it. And then I think we're going to have a little bit of a conversation to maybe see where we can bridge the gap. So what I want to start with is just a short video. I'm going to show you the beginning of a little movie we made, actually about 3.5 minutes. And it just gives you a little bit of a sense of, when I say robot, what I mean, because there's a lot of confusion out there about what a robot even is. And I'll talk a little bit after you see the video about why robotics and AI is both an incredibly powerful combination, but also so hard to do. In many ways, we set out to do something impossible. We set out to build a machine that, without any human assist or control, would work alongside us and help us out in the real world. We have, as humans, this inexplorable, the tallest mountains. We explore space. That's partly who we are as people. We're exploring the frontier of how you bring a sense of intelligence and understanding and cooperation with people into a machine. How do you give a machine the level of intelligence and smarts necessary to make it able to work alongside us and help us out in our daily life? That's the stuff of science fiction.
The challenge is to say, we want robots that can perform usefully and safely in completely unstructured environments alongside people. That is the vision for everyday robots.
That's such a simple word, everyday. That the type of challenges you encounter every day are just, there's just a myriad.
Everyday robots was trying to do is unlike anything else in the industry.
Making a robot operate in human spaces is a really big deal. It changes from a thing that's very niche to a thing that can be literally everywhere.
In order for something to be a prospective moonshot, there has to be a huge problem with the world that you want to solve. There has to be some radical proposed solution for how you want to solve it. And there has to be some technology aha at the middle of that.
For us, a moonshot meant to create something at a scale and level that had multi-purpose, ubiquitous learning robot in everyday environments.
Already, even around this environment, as the robots live amongst us and work amongst us as a team, it's normal to have everyday robots part of our workplace, which is super strange, right?
There's going to be robots among us at some point, and we have to make sure that their actions are aligned with human intention.
So that just gives you a little bit of a flavor of the sort of world I came from, where I come from. And there's so much to say about this. The reason I jumped onto stage and sat down here and reached over and grabbed for that water bottle is, if you could get a robot to do that autonomously, not pre-programmed and not sort of, you know, all scripted, but if you could get it to do that autonomously, first off, why would it do it? Why would a robot pick up a water bottle? It doesn't drink water. So it has to understand the world around it in a way that is incredibly difficult. So if you could do that, if there was a Nobel Prize in robotics, it would probably be awarded to that little thing I just did right here. And body is trying to make a body, a mechanical body, work in the real world, understand the real world, and autonomously perform tasks in the real world is very, very difficult. So that said, the robots are coming. There's no question in my mind that it won't be that long I mean, I see some people in this room that might be older than me. I see a lot of people that are younger. Certainly in some of our lifetime, this will start happening. We had built 200 of these robots you just saw on stage, on the video. We had probably 20 or 30 of them deployed in 5 Google buildings every day, fully autonomously wiping tables, sorting trash, inspecting conference rooms, doing air quality inspection as they were moving around the buildings, navigating completely autonomously, performing tasks completely autonomously. And it was all because of AI. AI was the only reason we were able to do that in this kind of way. So I think the best thing here is probably for me to just hit the pause button right now and we can start a conversation and we'll sort of take it from there.
Thank you so much. I think I just want to underline one aspect of this world, which you taught me over the years, is like we take for granted things that to us come easy and we don't value them. But we value things that for us are difficult. So it's very hard for us to compute really hard mathematical models. So we think, oh, robot, our computer is so amazing. But we don't. If somebody shows a robot picking up a ball, you're like, oh, what's the big deal? It's a huge deal. And I want to just talk a little bit about the mechanism by which you taught robots how to be autonomous. This is the technology.
Yeah. So if you think about the continuum, maybe, one end of the continuum is you want the robot to do something very specific, but you want it to be resilient. Like I was just listening to your conversation about surgical robots, and I could immediately, although I know nothing about it, I could immediately see why this was challenging, because you need, even in that particular use case, the robot needs to do what a human does, which is be very sensitive and understand in a deeper way, even like what a bone is and the difference between bone and human tissue, skin, and all these things are really hard to represent. So on the one hand, Google had a problem, huge amount of landfill that was basically could have been recycled or organic material and compost, but because people would just walk back by these bins and not remember the difference between a yellow and a green one, they just throw something in the bin and it would be, so everything would have to go to landfill. So you thought you were doing the right thing, but you weren't. So we said, well, this is a good job for the robots. They can just go over to the bins, peek in the bins, and sort stuff. We taught them to do that. We didn't program them. We taught them. So every time a robot picked something out of a bin, which it learned to do, we didn't program it to pick it up. We taught it to pick it up. And we taught it that, in other, by training it in, you know, hundreds of thousands of samples, maybe even millions of times, it would reach into the bin, and we would watch it do things like reaching for a Coke bottle, but the Coke bottle wasn't really accessible from its particular kind of grasp angle. And so it would nudge other things out of the way to get to the Coke bottle. We never programmed it to do that. It learned how to do that. Then it would pick up the Coke bottle, see that it had it in its hand, and then learn to put it in the blue bin. So we were able to solve a very simple problem by teaching the robots. And there were two techniques to teach. We ran a giant simulator. So in the last 2022, we had 240 million robots running in a cloud simulator so that they could basically practice doing a particular task in simulation. Then once they'd practice in simulation, we would take all the learning, the models that have been trained in simulation, and transfer that onto a physical robot. And then we had a little, you might have seen a glimpse of it in the little video, but there was we called it the robot playpen. There were like 20 robots standing around sorting trash all day. And by the way, they don't get bored, so they can do this. But they would take the models from the simulator and then bring it into the robot so it could train and learn to do something. So this is one of the ways you would train it, but you would train it on a very specific task, in this case, trash sorting. And then you could generalize that somewhat. We would train it to open doors. You saw it behind the woman who said, every day is such a simple word. Behind her, there was a robot training and learning how to open doors. We did it in simulation, ran millions of tests and attempts in simulation, and then those and reinforced the positive results and negatively reinforced the failures, and then transfer that onto the robot.
So one other thing, and the other path of that is once one robot learned, all the robots learned, right?
That's exactly right. So that's the other, but once they started learning, and of course we had hundreds of millions of robots in simulation, and once they learned, you know, every robot instantly knew how to do that particular thing. So you learn to open one particular door, even if a robot had never seen that door before, or even if a robot approached a door that no robot had ever seen, they could generalize and they could basically try it out a little bit and learn to open doors.
So Stefan, do you think we can do that transfer learning so I can learn how to do things as well as you can?
I think that's exactly the question I was going to ask. You know, that's the beauty about having a robot, one, learn and then transfer that knowledge to any robot you build thereafter. And that's the big challenge in orthopedics. You know, I recently had a resident work with me for a month, and then I have my new partner who's been out for 3 years, and I'm trying to teach them what I do. And it's a huge challenge because I have the knowledge and the experience, but I can't transfer that very easily. So the learning process in medicine is so much different. And so how can we make robots learn from other surgeons? Is it cameras in the operating room? Is it analyzing movements of surgeons? And how can we reduce the learning curve for new surgeons coming out using robotics? What are your thoughts?
For me, is the fact that they're working on a human body, it's pretty difficult to simulate a human body.
Right. All prototypes.
Yes. And so, and I wouldn't want to be part of the training set as we're sort of training up these robots. And I did use the word millions, right? You need so many examples and so many attempts to learn even fairly simple things. So I think learning, I mean, transferring your old knowledge into of how to perform surgery into a robot, I think it's going to be one of the longer pull things. But I mean, we saw earlier this example, I forget what the name of the company was, but just a moment ago, the sort of the one step ahead idea. Like I was talking to Stefano the other day and he said, well, could a robot just sit next to you and you know what your next step is? So provide you with the tools and sort of always be following along and be dexterous enough that it could reach to where you are and really sort of be a very knowledgeable, dexterous assistant. That I think is very much within reach, right? And no pun intended. And I think that even things like picking up, I'll use the word I know, so I'm picking up a tool for you, even that and doing it resiliently, right? Let's say you put the light that you use at an angle where it sort of reflects off that piece of equipment on the table, the robot might mistake it. That is an area where AI is definitely a solution, right? So when you look at the total continuum of what can be done, I think there's lots and lots of areas where autonomous robots will start emerging, post-op, sort of pre-op, you know, even assist during op. But getting in there and performing surgery, knowing what I know, if I needed a hip or a knee replacement and somebody said, well, we're going to have a robot do it autonomously, I'd say no. I wouldn't go there. And I think it's going to be a while until I would say otherwise.
But the analogy is autonomous cars, right? Humans have much more wrecks than autonomous cars. But once an autonomous car has a wreck, then it's a huge lawsuit and it's a huge issue. And people don't want to use an autonomous car because of that reason. Because I could imagine if you could train a robot to be a much better surgeon than a human.
It will happen. I mean, that's, again, the robots are coming. This will happen. I think it's just what I'm trying to highlight is just the gap. So that's doing backflips. You watch, you know, Boston Dynamics, which when I started my time at Google, we had just bought Boston Dynamics. You know, we decided to spin them back out again because robots give you really good YouTube. I mean, robots are really, they look really good on a YouTube video. But those YouTube videos, don't ever trust anything you see on a YouTube video that has a robot in it. Boston Dynamics has never shown anything where there wasn't a person out of the frame with a joystick controlling the robot. None of that stuff you've ever seen wasn't completely, it's no different than going to a Disney theme park. There's no difference between what you see in those robots doing and something that's completely pre-programmed and pre-scripted. So the hard part isn't really the mechatronics. I mean, those are getting pretty good. Even the haptic feedback and the sort of, the hard part is understanding what is supposed to happen and understanding and the whole feedback mechanism involved in that. That and understanding, like when I jumped up here and reached over and picked up that bottle and sat down on this chair, that is hard. That is, as you were saying, you know, it's more of a paradox, is this idea that what's easy for humans is hard for robots and what's hard for computers and what's hard for computers is easy for humans. So picking up a bottle, I don't even have to think. I can just bring a very large, complicated calculation is very hard for me. A computer does it like that. And this sort of that very much applies in robotics.
In a way, that should be a perfect opportunity for symbiosis. Let's go to user interface. I think that within the robots that we work with, one of the differentiating features is just how useful it is, how easy it is. And I think we heard from OrthoGrid just now that they spend so much time in the UI and decreasing cognitive load of the interface. What did you learn while building the everyday robot about the human-robot interface interaction?
So a few comments on that. I think early on when I came in, it was a bit of a mess. Larry and Andy Rubin, the former head of Android, had basically bought a bunch of robot companies. There were 9 of them they bought, including Boston Dynamics. And then it had become a bit of a mess and nobody knew what to do with them. So my job was to help figure that out and sort of clean up a bit. Lots of incredible people, lots of incredible technology in a screwed up organization. That's kind of the way you want it. If something's going to be screwed up, it's better to be the organization you can fix that. So we came in and I started listening to peeps. The first thing I said is, this robot will not have screens. The first thing I said was, AI is the only way we're going to solve these problems. The second thing was, we're not going to have any screens. And the reason is, I don't want people reaching over and poking at this thing. And I want to set the bar really high. So if you don't have a screen, what do you have left? Voice and gesture. I think voice and gesture will be significantly important parts of the whole. Like if you're standing there with some implement in a knee and you need something, you should be able to just turn to the robot and say, put it over here, or and just point with your pinky. Or you should be able to, I mean, I think voice, and we can see this now with LLMs, how voice is kind of, just like vision has become a bit of a solved problem, voice is becoming a solved problem. And so being able to speak, like that video you saw Stefano showed earlier of the plate and the cup, that again, don't believe YouTube videos, that was 95, maybe 97% ChatGPT and 3% robot. The robot was probably fairly scripted to do that task. And so the real thing that happened was ChatGPT could take the camera in the robot's head, look at the scene and parse it. If you, what can I do with this? ChatGPT would give you, or maybe Gemini. So what happens is the affordances from that are then made available. So then the robot has a set of affordances. It can pick things up. It can turn them around. It can move things from one hand to the other. And all it, you have to do is map the understanding of the voice command to those affordances. And then the robot can do it. We did some very cool stuff with that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And so I think speech is probably at some level the lowest hanging fruit and the most interesting part of the UI. I do think poking at things is problematic, but pointing is obviously something we do a lot, and gesturing and nodding and gazing. This is all important. So I think AIs should be able to understand that and use that, I believe, as an important part of the interface to assist you in whatever situation you're in, whether it's surgical or just at your home. Like, hey, can you take those potatoes and move them off move that pot off the stove? Why shouldn't you just be able to say that? As a, you know, you wouldn't want to reach for your iPhone and start tapping, you know, if the robot to do that, right?
Just want to underline that technology. So the robot, which knows how to do things, it can program itself to pick up a cup, went to the web for the cups or the plates, understood that's a cup of plate by asking ChatGPT and then executed on that task. Is that about what happened?
Yeah. So technically we just use the APIs, but the ChatGPT APIs, but basically what happens is you get the robot has a microphone and it has a camera and it gets a request, which is, you know, look at what you're seeing and send it off to ChatGPT. Because we had the robots, you saw those little kind of creatures you saw on the screen a little while ago. Those things had an A100 GPU in them. That, for those of you who know what that is, that's a $12,000 GPU, just that one card, plus a bunch of other stuff. So they could do some local inference. A lot of the time what happens is what you see is going to be in the cloud, right? So it's going to be popping back to some large language model or some probably, you know, some multimodal model. And then you're going to get some, again, a list of affordances back, which the robot can then figure, like a list of actions back, and then the robot that is mapped to the robot's affordances, in other words, what it can accomplish. And then from there, it can then essentially figure out what to do. Final thing, though, the whole AI thing is also complicated that way, because while we've seen hallucinations in the text space, it's a system problem. It's a systemic problem with the algorithms, right? It's not about text. It'll hallucinate pretty much anything it does, thinking that the model will think that it's doing something in response to stimuli and just simply make shit up if it doesn't know
It'll just make stuff up because that's what models do.
So if we were to develop a robot that is a surgical assistant or hands us the instruments, you just videotape 1,000 surgeries, feed that into the system, and they will figure out what the next instrument is? Because there's not a whole lot of surgical video in the cloud currently, right? Because it's a fairly limited set of data set out there. But is that how you would train the robot, right?
Yeah, we used to say that we envision a day when the robot just sits around watching YouTube and sort of do-it-yourself videos on YouTube and figures out how to do things. So, and we put that, we were starting to scratch at that a little bit because when people move towards each other in crowded environments, we signal with body language, you know, whether we see each other, we might be a little nod or a little eye contact. There's very subtle things that we obviously don't think about, but we signal, and our morphology is, of course, familiar, so we know the signals. We were starting to use, so navigation was actually not learned. It was not AI. It was something we solved with more traditional technology. But how we navigate, how we indicate with our body language, how we're going to move, we needed to figure that out so that people were comfortable around the robots. In that case, what we used was AI to look at YouTube videos of how people approached each other, just random videos of crowds. And it could look at body movement and body motion, and we could create train algorithms. So yes, I would say you would look at videos and you would just look at ideally fairly large numbers of them. And then from that, you would train the model to sort of know. Now, if it's very systemic and methodical, all you might have to do is look at images and say, well, after this image, now we're at this stage, we come to the next one. So it might not even, if every surgery is performed in a series of sequential steps, you might not even need to look at the whole video. You can just take, well, we're at this stage now because I recognize this form of image. Now we're ready to go to the next stage. So we can, there's a procedure for whether you, everybody essentially follows a similar process.
Definitely have a question for you. So having worked in the robotic space for so long, I just wanted to ask you the same question I asked a group of roboticists when I was traveling in Lyon. And what is the core value proposition of a robot? What does it give us that we can't get? How does the technology deliver value to the question that was posed earlier, statement was posed earlier?
Yeah,
I'll tell you what they said.
I think there's multiple value proposition of the robot. One, I think that's fairly untapped. It is a huge set of data, because you now know how you put in the implants. And I think unless we know what we did in surgery, how can we improve? And so that data set will help us, whether we use machine learning or AI, to then correlate an intraoperative surgical plan and intraoperative execution of a surgical plan also with clinical outcome. I think that's one set. So you know, accuracy is always one of those things, but none of the systems do accuracy studies, which is shocking to me to this day. But if you have a surgical plan, you can more accurately execute that surgical plan. And I think probably the biggest value is that it commoditizes a good community surgeons who do less surgery, better surgeons. So, you know, I do 1,100 surgeries a year. For me, it's fairly routine, but there's still, I think, 70% of knee replacements are done by surgeons who do 20 or less a year. Now, is that the surgeon that can really incorporate a new technology like a robot? You know, in the future, I think it can, because our kids grow up with iPhones and robots and all kinds of stuff. And so hopefully this will commoditize a better clinical approach to the community surgeon.
It's interesting. When we got done with two bottles of really brilliant red wine in Lyon, we came up with trust. And the idea that through the robot, you can trust that your intent has been executed as you'd planned. Because it's an awful lot of doing manual surgery, just not 100% sure, and all the planning that goes ahead of it. How would you respond to that?
I think that's a great point, because before I did robotic surgery, you know, you think like you did a great job, and then you feel the knee, and it doesn't really feel right. I guess I didn't trust myself doing the right thing. And now I think much more often I look at a surgical plan, I change it slightly, I execute that plan, and then it feels, oh, this feels great. And I agree, I think that's a great value put in data to make it a better product. And I think that's where robotics can really play a huge role. I don't think we're there yet, but hopefully we will continue to iterate and get there.
I want to change pace a little bit. And then I'm going to take a few questions. The answer we never do, but this is such a big topic. I'll definitely give it, open up a little bit. But One of the roboticists was also the in-house artist or something to that effect. And I've seen other videos where you train the robots to dance and you yourself are a terrific artist, as it turns out, a wonderful photographer, and you're very involved with the arts. What's the role of bringing people into the equation who don't think the same way as a roboticist, as an engineer? In our case, it's a surgeon.
Well, first, I think we need more women on stage here.
Yes.
So I think we were building or attempting to build robots that were going to live amongst us and work alongside us one day. And they are coming. We have the Institute of the Future, and SRI has this really lovely quote, which is, "Don't confuse a clear vision with a short path." Right. So I'm standing on a mountaintop and I'm looking down into the valley and I'm looking over the other side. It's like, I can see where I'm going. That's it. That's the end goal. That's where I'm going to arrive. But there are alligators in the valley and big rivers and flooding and, you know, and all kinds of ugly stuff. And I need to make it over. So in order to get there, get through the valley, get up the mountain, I need a team. Right. And that team needs to have a whole bunch of experience. I'm up in the alpine landscape right now, but I need to make it down into the valley and there's jungle down there and it's tropical, and then I need to make it back up again. I need a team with experience doing all these things. So in robotics, for me, that translated into, well, at Google, we had this opportunity to convene. When we convened publicly, everybody would just grandstand. But when we could convene privately, we were able to bring in people that had really interesting and at times very controversial perspectives. So I had an artist in residence on board, Katie Kwan, who you saw up there. She was also a PhD in robotics. She was a former dancer, danced at the Metropolitan Ballet in New York, but was also a PhD, was getting her PhD in robotics at Stanford at the time. Katie was amazing, and her training was movement. It was emotion and movement. Like, how do we feel when something moves? If I do this, it evokes a sudden reaction, right? That's the saber-toothed tiger thing. So movement, when something starts moving, it changes. And not only that, it moves into our workplace. And like, people are talking a lot about the future of work these days. I think it's entirely the wrong conversation. The robots will be the future of work, including your jobs, by the way. It just will take a while. The robots will be smarter, faster, more efficient than us in every level. And by robots, I mean the total AI space. So what we really should be talking about is the nature of work and even like what it means to be human in an age of intelligent machines. So if we're talking about that, who are we talking with? We had a philosopher on board. We had a former labor leader, Andy Stern, former head of the SEIU. We had anthropologists. We had designers, of course. We had economists. So we were able to convene this group of people in a conversation that was starting not after we'd created the robots, but while we were creating the robots. And just one last thing on that, because I'm pretty passionate about this. One last thing about that is, the people working on every day are really smart. They had concerns. The employees had concerns. They were looking at this stuff and saying, holy shit, it just nudged that thing out of the way and picked something up. It learned how to do that. Well, I never programmed it to do that. It's figuring shit out on its own, right? That's kind of like, what does that mean? What's that mean to my future job? What's it mean to my family and my children? And so by having this dialogue, this very honest and raw and open dialogue and inviting people in with different perspectives, people realized that it was okay to have these concerns. It was okay to have the conversation. And so just one last little thing, since I started with the gender comment, when I first sat down with the team, I came in early 2016, spent a few weeks, and then I figured out who kind of the thought leaders and the doers were in the team. And we sat down and we had this conversation about beliefs and what people thought about and what they believed could be done and what couldn't be done. And I was really getting a crash course education. And about half an hour into the conversation, I paused it and I said, does anybody in this room notice something that's off? And the first guy said something about the lighting. And the second man said, there are 12 of us, 13 of us sitting around the table. Here we're building robots that will ultimately take care of old people, that will live amongst us in our homes. There was a single woman sitting around the room. It took me 7 years. So after 5 years, my leadership team was 50% women. And I got a lot of flack for not including LGBTQT and all the other stuff in my selection. But like I said, look, we're not big enough. There's one thing we can do. Let's focus on gender. Let's get to 33% across the board, at which point it's self-sustaining. So you solve for these things with intention. And when that started happening, when people realized that they had to actually interview, I mean, we always hired the best person. There was never a quota, but we had to, the interview pipeline had to include diversity. The conversation just got more interesting. So yes, I think bringing a diverse group of people around the table, not because it's a checkbox you need to check, but because it actually generates better results. It creates a better outcome. This was critical to how I ran the project and to how we thought about things.
I mean, that's incredibly refreshing to hear you say this, because I think one of the challenges in healthcare is that we work in these silos. There's the hospital, there's the physician, there's the insurance company, there's the patient, there's the third-party payers sitting out of control because we work in these silos. We never sit down into a room together with different stakeholders and say, you know, how can we build a better mousetrap? And it's extremely frustrating because I've gone through this. I was in private practice, then I was employed, then I was back into private practice because I got so frustrated with that. So it's incredibly encouraging to see what you, to hear what you're saying, that women, we need artists, we need, you know, kids. I mean, young people have a completely different perspective than us old people who are just so mindset and live inside a box. Many of the Nobel Prize were developed by a graduate student with a crazy idea and a professor who had the knowledge who said, yeah, that is a crazy idea, but if we're going to make this, this is how we need to do it. The perfect example is monoclonal antibody was developed by a graduate student and a professor. Because the graduate student said, well, why can't we use a cancer cell and merge it with a antibody-producing cell and make an antibody-producing cancer cell? And sure enough, it ended up winning the Nobel Prize. So I think bringing in outside people to the discussion can be very critical to solving some of the problems we're having in healthcare today and in robotics.
So we can keep going, obviously, but are there any questions from the audience? My dad. Okay, fine. You get one soon.
Hans Peter, is it possible to train and to teach a robot to invent, to have intuition or not? I have my answer.
I think yes, but it's controversial. I have a small kind of mindfulness practice, and one of the things I love to do during meditation is to look for the looker, that little technique people do where you just look for the self. And when I think about, and for those of you who might not be familiar with it, you know, you're sitting there, you're focusing on a breath, you're just like paying attention, then your thoughts come in and they start poking around, and then you go back, oops, I'm thinking, let's go back to my breath, and the thoughts kind of dissipate. But then while you're doing that, as you're doing it, you have this moment where you go, who am I? Who is the I in this? Who is the looker? Who is actually thinking? And there is no thinker. It's just thoughts. It's just breath, right? So could a robot or an AI, let's keep it in the AI space here, basic, I promise I won't go long on this one, but if I step back and I say, well, so what are those thoughts? Well, I'm flying to Paris in 2 hours, for example, right now. This is a true statement. So in the back of my mind, I'm like, am I going to get there in time? There's all the sort of thoughts going on. I had a little bit of breakfast before I left home this morning. I haven't had any caffeine. This influences my very state of being at this very moment. The air pressure, the air quality in this room, the fact that I'm sitting in front of you all, and probably my, you know, certain hormones were kind of are slightly elevated or whatever it happens, right? And I've got a little bit of stress hormones. So all this stuff influences how I'm thinking and how I'm appearing right now. Well, you could imagine that happening in different ways, but an AI consciousness, an AI creativity won't be the same as ours. I think it'll actually be eventually very different. We might not even recognize it as such because it'll be different. Just like a dog can be creative in how it problem solves, but we don't recognize it maybe as creativity. So yes, I think there will be different kinds of intelligences. And I think we're creating a new species. And I think that species will ultimately outperform us, which is why it's important to figure out what it means to be human.
Just a quick question about hallucinations that relate to a community rather than an individual that's dealing with a robot. Because as that robot was putting away the dishes into the dish rack, I heard my wife behind me saying, why the hell are you putting a clean dish in the dish rack and not back into the cabinet? Do you know what I mean? So there are different perspectives that we have to deal with. And how do we sort of arrange the hallucinations are not just one person's perspective, but a community's perspective.
Yes. So just to distinguish hallucinations from the right solution in context. So Stefano mentioned this technology or this sort of approach called RAG earlier, which is a way to contextualize an answer. So in this case, your wife's preferences for not only hot, but maybe stack the blue ones under the red ones or something, or my preferences for how I want my glasses in my closet, this could be customized and the robot could just learn it in situ, in context. So it wouldn't apply that to your, it wouldn't provide my glass stacking in your situation, although stacking glasses would be a fundamental underlying thing. Hallucinations would be thinking that a Coke bottle should be stacked with the glasses, or concluding that its models are prone to making things up because there's no, remember, ChatGPT came out 2 years ago. This is so in its infancy. We're just scratching the surface. And so I think the hallucinations will be a solved problem, but they are inclined, and back to your question about creativity and invention. I mean, don't we have to hallucinate a little bit to be creative, to invent? I think a lot of creativity comes from thinking outside the box, thinking in ways that aren't the way others would think. Is that, I mean, hallucination maybe is the wrong word, but some form of like not following the normal path, following a different path, and then arriving somewhere new. I mean, this is what invention and creativity is about, right? And so in some ways, hallucination is a feature, but if robots autonomously doing something in my knee, I would probably consider it a bug.
Can I pose the last question? Maybe I think we still have 2 minutes, so it's a very simple question, actually. We talked a lot about robots and about robot on the AI and about the developments, but you two are really visionaries in your field, so I think I can pose this question. Where will be, if you envision a future, our role to Stefan as an orthopedic surgeon, also in other areas of work? Because you said labor will not, we don't talk about labor anymore, but where will be our role in work processes when everything is done by an AI-trained robot?
I can speak for me, and actually was posed that question by a medical student, a visiting student with me, and I think one thing that will never be replaced in medicine is the human touch. So, I mean, when I'm in clinic and a lady's upset about a bad outcome and I give her a hug or I touch her hand or have an eye contact or the warmth, that will never be replaced by a robot. And I think in healthcare, that's extremely important. We can become more efficient. We can do more joints per day. We can become more precise, and the robots will improve in efficiency and accuracy of diagnosis and so forth. But that human touch interaction will never be replaced by a robot, in my opinion.
I probably disagree on a long arc, but on a short arc, you know, certainly I think probably mostly in our lifetimes that's probably true. I would agree with that statement. Look, I think work as we know it is a fairly modern phenomenon, right? It's industrial since, and even like the agricultural revolution was a huge shift because it went from people like very dexterous, climbing trees and picking berries and moving around, to standing with some kind of implement and doing this all day. And then as you started scaling that a little bit, and you had serfs working. In fact, I mean, this was not good for humanity in many ways, good for humans. People lived better lives pre-ag revolution, as pretty much up until the industrial revolution. And then I think we've in some ways lived better lives, although it's hard to say what a good life is for everyone, right? So I think humans, I'm going to get slightly philosophical here, but we need to redefine what it means to be human. Today, we define so much of it in terms of what does work give us, right? It gives us money, of course. It gives us sustenance. That, but if the robots are more productive, we should be able to solve that. But it also gives us a sense of identity. It gives us a sense of community, and it gives us a sense of purpose. Does identity, community, and purpose need to be tied to work, or could it be tied to creative pursuits or pursuits otherwise? So in a utopian sense, assuming the robots want to keep us around, it's going to free up a whole ton of stuff, but culturally, we're not prepared for it. We're so identified with work. We think that there's a lot of memes that if people don't work, they'll start drinking and become derelicts and, you know, and do drugs. Well, that can be fun sometimes, but as long as you don't overdo it. But I think that that's a very simplistic view of the future and of humanity. So aren't we all striving to make the money so that we can take more time off and so that we can spend more time with loved ones and family and friends and travel? Well, what if we didn't? Yeah. So I think those are the types of questions. I have no clue what happens to humans once these machines become really smart and super intelligent and dexterous and capable. But I am convinced that that will happen. So then the questions become fairly wide-ranging.
With that, we'll call that session to an end. It is what DocSF is all about. We're cross-collaborating. We're bringing new ideas in. We're going to get into the real practical next when we start talking about new startups. Very excited. Hopefully this seeded some conversation for the break. You can go to the break behind this wall here, and we'll see you back thereafter. Thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Digital Orthopedics Podcast, and hope you'll make a note to join us for the next Digital Orthopedics Conference San Francisco in October. Take care. Bye.